This episode of Rhodey Radio is brought to you by free outdoor Wi-Fi at your library. Park or sit outside at your local Ocean State Library and connect to the library parking lot network. No password or library card required. There is no time limit on outdoor Wi-Fi, so feel free to enjoy a beautiful day while getting work done, binging your favorite show, or playing online games. This project has been made possible with generous funding from the Rhode Island Take It Outside Initiative and the Rhode Island Foundation, with a generous donation of equipment from the Information Technology Disaster Resource Center, and through partnerships with OCEAN, the Ocean State Higher Education Economic Development and Administrative Network, and your local public library.
You're listening to Rhodey Radio, Rhode Island Library Radio online. Welcome to If These Walls Could Talk, a new segment on Rhodey Radio where we learn about the historic houses of Rhode Island. Rhode Island was founded in 1636 and its long history has been well preserved. House museums are a great way to learn about what everyday life was like at different times in history, and with over 30 different historic house museums throughout the state, there's a lot to learn about life in Rhode Island from the colonial era through present day. I'm your host, Lauren Walker, from the Rhodey Radio crew and Coventry Public Library. I love to go to historic house museums to learn about how people used to live, and also to learn about how architecture and interior design have changed over the years. I'm excited to tour Rhode Island's many historic homes, talk with the people who take care of them, and share all of this great history with our listeners. Today, I'm at the Warwick Public Library recording studio again, home of Warwick Radio Online, a podcast featuring news and stories about Warwick's people, businesses, and one-of-a-kind culture, available wherever you find your podcasts. A big thank you to Will, the community services librarian at Warwick Public Library, for offering this space for us to record today. I'm joined by Brian Zinzer, docent and vice president of the Board of Trustees at the Major General Nathaniel Green Homestead in Coventry, Rhode Island. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
Tell me a little bit about the history of the Nathaniel Green Homestead.
The history of the Nathaniel Green Homestead actually started here in Warwick in Pottawamat, which is right at the East Greenwich line. And that's where he was born, which it was a family forge there, iron forge. And when he was old enough to become an iron master himself, his father actually opened up a second forge in Coventry, to which Nathaniel and his older brother Jacob started working there.
Interesting. So when was the house built?
In 1770.
Oh, all right. 6 years before the big year.
Yeah.
And was it built by his father or?
No. Actually, Nathaniel built it himself, but he did get the help with his brothers as well. In total, he had seven siblings, including himself.
Oh, okay. Lots to help out.
Yeah, right.
I'm guessing it's just kind of like a basic colonial style. Does it have a particular style to it?
It is just a colonial style, and it's modeled exactly after the home that he grew up in.
Oh, okay. Here in Warwick?
Yes.
Interesting. So did he build the house for himself, or did his whole family live there?
He built the house for himself, but then he actually let his brother Jacob kind of live there as well. The forge was actually opened in 1762, so they were riding their horses back and forth, which is roughly about 14 miles.
Yeah, that's pretty far.
Yeah, you know, you can imagine working in an iron forge after riding a horse 14 miles and then riding back and doing for 8 years.
When I talked to the people at the Payne House, they said that part of the reason why Coventry was founded was so that they didn't have to keep going to Warwick for things.
I'm not sure if that's true, but you could be right.
Yeah, I could be misremembering, but I think it was something along those lines of like they founded a town so that they could have stuff close to them instead of having to go to Warwick all the time. Mm. So you give tours at the homestead, correct?
Yes.
What are some of the main questions that people ask on the tours?
The main question, the number one main question is, who is this guy and why is there a museum after him? It's a little different here in Rhode Island, even though he spent the majority of his life here. He's not really a household name here. But if you go down south where he did his best work, there's not many people who don't know his name.
Oh, interesting. I know I recently found out that he was like George Washington's right-hand man, and it surprised me that none of us know who he is.
Right. His right-hand man, and from 1778 on, he was actually second in charge of the entire army.
Wow.
And then you get to 1779, he was in charge of every troop from Delaware to Georgia.
Wow. You would think that, you know, Rhode Island is so proud of its history. You'd think that more people would know about that.
Well, living in a state that actually has over 20% of all national historic landmarks in the entire nation, we definitely take pride in our history, but we're missing a little bit.
Yeah. So has the house ever been, like, renovated or added to, or is this the way it's always looked?
Yes, no. It hasn't always looked this way. The Greens had actually lived in that house until 1899, and they still owned it until 1919, but they opened it up to be a boarding school. And at that time, they added an addition to the corner of the home. In 1924, the Nathaniel Green Homestead Association was formed in order to buy the property and turn it into the museum. When that was done, we opened the museum, or they opened the museum, I guess you could say. And it became open to the public, but it wasn't really that popular yet. In the 1930s, we underwent a major restoration to bring it as close to the original as it could be.
Oh, okay.
Including removing that big L to it.
Oh, okay. That addition isn't there anymore?
No, not at all.
Gotcha.
No. We do have pictures of it, and it's part of the tour to be able to see that while you're in there.
Oh, okay.
In the 1990s, we had another semi-renovation, and it was more of a paint, and we were actually matching the colors that were there when General Green actually built the home.
Oh.
So there are a few that are different for good reasons, and you'll see on a tour if you come.
How were you able to figure out what they were? Did you just kind of like scratch away the layers?
Exactly, right. And we had to actually go to Sherman Williams for the paint for that, because nobody else could actually carry the paint or match the paint.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of colors in there. Almost every room is a different color.
Oh, wow. I guess, did he have a lot of money? Like, because I would think that having a different color for every room was not common back then.
Definitely not common. I'm glad you picked up on that. That was actually one of the ways to show you had a lot of money. Mount Vernon was the same way. Unfortunately, some of those are very hideous colors, but they are different colors throughout the whole home.
Hideous colors now, but back then they really liked them, just like in the
70s. I'd like to think so, but I'm not sure how. Yeah, no.
Maybe they were just an anomaly, so it was the novelty of it more so than the aesthetic.
The other way they showed that they had a lot of money was ceiling height, mm-hmm. and he has 9-foot ceilings throughout his home in eight rooms. So he definitely had a lot of money. This isn't comparable to like the John Brown House in Providence, but it is considered a mansion, and it's actually known as Rhode Island's Mount Vernon too.
Oh, we'll have to make people know that more.
Yeah, please.
So what would a day in the life look like for the people who live there?
It depends on what your role was there. There was an iron forge, obviously. There was also a sawmill, a blacksmith shop, and also a paper mill, too.
All on the property?
All on the property.
Oh, wow.
It was originally over 400 acres there. So depending on what you were doing, you would actually just show up to work. And this actually brings up a really key point. If you've ever actually seen the sign that's out front, you'll notice it says Spell Hall. That's what Nathaniel Green called it in only one of his letters. But the reasoning behind that was it was actually Coventry's first school.
Oh.
He never had he was a Quaker. His father was a Quaker minister as well.
Okay.
So he never had a formal education, even though he longed for one. But he believed that people should be educated. So when his forge workers would come in to work for the day, they would bring in their children to take lessons during the day.
Oh, that's really nice. So was it called Spell Lake Spelling, or just he just picked it?
He just mentioned it was called Spell Hall in that one particular letter without reasoning.
All right.
Your assumption's probably the same as mine there.
Well, that's really nice. So he would get up in the morning, go to work, his workers would come in, and their kids would go to school. So I'm assuming he hired a teacher as well, or was that one of his family members?
It was one of the family members, and typically actually his wife, Katie, or he actually called her Kitty.
Okay. Catherine?
Yeah. Catherine Littlefield.
That's very interesting. What do you think is the most interesting fact about the homestead?
One of them is the fact that four of his descendants, who are also members of the SAR, which is the Sons of American Revolution, found it necessary to buy this property and renovate it to become a museum for people to see and celebrate this man's life. So that part's rather interesting.
Yeah. And what is your favorite room in the house?
The library.
It's probably my favorite room, too.
Right? It's not what you would expect in a typical library like we were in. There's no bookshelves at all.
Oh.
He, not being allowed to have a formal education, he was only allowed to learn, in his case, two separate books, one of them being the Bible as a Quaker. But because they had the iron forge and the family business, he was allowed to learn bookkeeping.
Okay.
It wasn't too long before his dad realized he was actually pretty exceptionally bright and basically retained all information that he read. So he told him that he can purchase his own books with his own money on his own time. And that's what he started doing, which amassed to 250 volumes that they called it compared to books.
Wow.
He kept them in trunks, too.
I was just going to say, so he had no shelves, so he just had trunks full of books.
Right. Well, not many. So there were shelves in the house, though, in certain rooms. And they were meant more for displaying china and things like that compared to books.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to how, if there was any organization in the trunks as a librarian, I'm thinking, like, how did he find the book he was looking for in a trunk?
From everything that I've read about him, and I just found three new books I have never seen here before, by the way, he was extremely organized and put most of us that think we're organized to shame.
Wow. All right. Maybe they were like spine up in the trunk so he could see all the spines. I'm trying to visualize. And what is the color of the library, since we were talking about wall color?
That's a very difficult question to answer. And I say that because it's either red or it's gray. Because we know during his time that the dining room and the library switched back and forth several times. And they're catty-cornered to each other. So last year we had the gray room as our library, and it's actually facing the front of the home. But now the last year's dining room is a library facing the rear of the home.
Oh. Hmm. So why preserve the homestead?
This is a man to celebrate. This is a man who was indispensable to the American Revolution. He's not known like some of the others, but it would not have been done without him.
Why do you say that specifically? Because I don't know anything about it. I haven't taken the tour yet, so.
When he gained control of all troops from Delaware to Georgia, he was given the Southern Campaign. We had two generals down there that had actually failed pretty miserably, I might add. And Congress finally gave Washington his choice compared to them choosing who goes down there. So he chose General Greene to go down there. And when General Greene went down there, he implemented basically a cat and mouse game. General Cornwallis, the British commander, was in Charlestown, so he was basically luring Cornwallis out of Charlestown and into the crest of the Appalachians, which is the western border at that point in time.
Okay.
But then he made a move that was just unprecedented at that time, too, and he split his army. It is always well known, don't split your army. And when he split his army, it forced Cornwallis to do the same. So now we had much smaller armies going at each other, giving General Greene a better chance. But the key to the strategy was he wanted to draw him away from the shore so he couldn't actually get replenished with any men or supplies. So the further that he pulled him out, the less and less Cornwallis had. In North Carolina, in Greensboro, North Carolina, the Battle of Guilford Courthouse took place. And this was after the split, but they came right back together just for this battle. It's hard to say who won. The standards of the day was whoever held the field at the end of the day won.
Mm-hmm.
But they basically both held the field afterwards, so it was a draw. Cornwallis did leave first, but I really don't know if I would count that as a full win compared to a draw. But it became a race to the Dan River, or a race to the Dan.
Okay.
The Dan River actually separates North Carolina and Virginia. It's almost along most of the border there. And basically, whoever crossed won, because he wasn't just depleting all of Cornwallis's supplies. He was also depleting his own, so he needed to replenish. So he got over first with all the boats replenished, and about 2 weeks later, Cornwallis followed him. At that time, General Greene went right back over the Dan River and started heading right back down south. Having all the supplies, he was in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
Cornwallis still wasn't taken care of, and he headed straight over to Yorktown and was riding back and forth and had plans to get himself back in shape over there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you know what happened at Yorktown.
I know it's important.
The best way to describe it is the unofficial ending of the war.
Gotcha.
The war went on for 2 years afterwards. But after the siege that Washington, Lafayette, and Rochambeau put on Yorktown with Cornwallis, and he surrendered over 6,000 troops, it was all but over at that point.
That was pretty much it.
Yeah.
All right.
The rest of the war, which oddly enough was the bloodiest part of the war, was General Greene. And he wanted to go reclaim the three port cities of Wilmington, North Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia. Which he did, and he actually saved South Carolina last. The Battle of Eutaw Springs, just outside of Charleston, was the final major engagement of the war, which he won. And he just sat on the outskirts of the city and watched them all leave, and then did a very ceremonious march into the city. And that was the end, because when they left, that was basically the last of the British to leave with the loyalists they took with them.
Wow. He really was, like, really important.
Yeah, very much so.
That's crazy that we don't know more about him. I hope this episode changes that.
I sure hope so, too. That's been our goal at the homestead for many, many years.
So when can people tour the house? What's the season, and what are the hours?
The season starts at the beginning of April, so basically April 1st into October 31st. And our hours on Friday through Monday are 10 till 5.
Okay. Is it like a tour every hour or?
It's not really a setup tour. If you do have a large group, please let us know so we can prepare for it. But otherwise, it's come on in. We'll take you as you come.
All right. And how much does a ticket cost?
There's three separate prices. If you're under 4, nothing. If you're under 12, it's $4. And anybody over is $8.
Okay. And do you offer membership? And if so, how much does it cost? And what do the proceeds go towards?
We do have memberships. We have a yearly or a lifetime.
Oh, okay.
And it's $25 for the year, or it's $500 for the lifetime. And if you purchase this, you get free tours and 10% off anything in the gift shop.
Oh, okay. Nice. And all of that goes towards the house?
Right.
Keeping
right.
it up?
We're actually a 501(c). And we're privately owned. The board actually owns the homestead.
Okay.
So people will come in and taking tours, donations, and grants. They're basically the only things keeping us open. And it's working so far.
I hope we get more people in there. So if anyone's interested in getting involved at the homestead, do you take volunteers?
We do. We are 100% volunteer.
So how would someone get involved? Do they just like go to your Facebook, or who do they reach out to?
You could go to our Facebook and definitely reach out to us through Messenger on there. You could always call us at the homestead, or don't hesitate to drop on by. We do have a live-in caretaker, and he'll be more than happy to help you.
Great. Is there anything else that you'd like the listeners to know about the homestead that we haven't mentioned yet?
One thing that actually happened just about over a year ago now. Originally, it was over 400 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Homestead Association was formed, it was dwindled down to 13 acres.
Oh, okay.
But the pharmaceutical plant that's just across the Patuxent River from us, who owned about 35 acres on our side of the river that was undeveloped, they actually donated it over to us.
Oh, wow.
Right. So that's a really big deal. And with that came a lot of hiking trails.
Oh.
And with that, I want to make this very clear. Our grounds are open to everybody at any time. We do ask that you respect the property, whatever you bring in, bring out, leash your dogs, and just be respectful. But please, enjoy the property.
That's really nice. I did not know that. You said that happened like a year ago?
Yeah.
Nice.
And it's about 3 miles back there. I did it right when we got it, and it's a pleasant walk.
Is it? Yeah, I was going to say. So, is it like just like a walk, or is it like more rocky?
It's a walk. It's not a very difficult trail. There are some hills, but if you need to avoid them, you can.
That's good to know. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
No problem. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. I hope you learned something new about your local history, and I encourage you to visit the Nathaniel Green Homestead to see it in person, learn even more about its fascinating history, and support its maintenance for future generations. The Coventry Public Library offers a museum pass to the homestead that can be used for free admission for two adults and children under 17. For more information about the Major General Nathaniel Green Homestead, visit their website at nathanielgreenhomestead.org. Rhode Radio is proud to be a resident partner of the Rhode Island Center for the Book and brought to you by library staff and community members all around the Ocean State. The project has been funded in part by grants from the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the American Library Association. You can find more from Rhode Radio on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And if you enjoyed today's episode, subscribe to Rhode Radio and rate or review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to help us reach more Rhode Islanders.